Okay, so what I'd like to do today is to give a talk on a teaching or a concept which is very important in teachings of the Buddha, but are not given kind of central stage in this terms of there's an explicit teaching like the Four Noble Truths or like the center of the Buddha's teachings or the Eightfold Path. But there's a teaching or a concept which is kind of a thread that runs throughout the Buddha's teachings, which is implicit, but is never really put center stage. So you wouldn't pick it up unless you were kind of pointing to it or you spent a lot of time reading his teachings and kind of synthesized it. And that's a teaching of skillful means, skillfulness. And developing a skill, becoming skillful, is very central to what the Buddha is teaching and his message. And as a way of beginning this exploration, I have a book on my bookcase, which I've never read. I also don't read Tricycle. It's called Religion and Human Nature. And one of the things that interests some people who are into religion or spirituality is what is human nature? What is it to be a human being? And especially people who are study spirituality or religion kind of academically, sooner or later get interested, what is it to be a human being? What is the nature of human being? How do we find it? And certainly Buddhists are interested in that topic also. And what's the essence of the human being? What's the true human nature? And I suppose part of the interest in finding that is so we can align ourselves with that. We can become it, implying that if we really know what human nature is, then we know what purpose of life, we know how to live our life, we know how to fulfill that our human nature. In the early Buddhist teaching, the human being, interestingly enough, and also the human mind, are primarily described as processes. The mind is not a thing. The mind is an activity. It's a process. The human being is not described as by things, the human psychophysical being, but rather as processes, as activities. So consciousness is not consciousness a thing, but rather it's a process of being conscious. Feeling is not a feeling kind of thing, but it's a process of feeling. Perception is not a thing, but it's a process of perceiving. The body is not a thing. The body is a process of activity and of sensing or feeling or moving, or I'm not sure exactly how to describe it. But everything is a process and an activity. And in that, the mind, the heart, the body, the psychophysical being is an activity, is a process. That process and activity can be shaped, can be developed, can be directed in certain directions. And it seems to me that this is very central to what it means to be a human being, is to be shaping and developing the capacities we have, developing skills, developing capacities. And I don't know if it should be the essence of what human nature, but it's very central to what it means to be a human being. And you see it, I see it now with my young son, who's now 5 weeks old. He does various things. He sleeps a lot. And he also, when he's awake, he spends a lot of time fussing because he's kind of trying to cope with all kinds of mostly internal things, his digestion and his intestines and his pooping. And all these things, you know, you can see his face contort and move and all kinds of things he does with his body trying to cope with what's there. But when he's not just trying to cope, and he's relaxed and alert, he spends a lot of time trying to master certain capacities he has. And one of them that he's slowly now getting in these first few weeks, he spent a lot of time trying to skill, he's a really important skill that probably none of you have ever really thought about much, but it's really so foundational to human being that he spent the first 4 or 5 weeks now trying to master this particular skill. And that is the skill of holding his head up. And, you know, it's a big deal, the coordination and the strength and everything. And, you know, the first few weeks, you know, we had to support him, you know, it's always supporting him. And now you can kind of do it for a little while. And Now, some of you who might watch me when I meditate might think I haven't learned that skill yet either. And also he's learning the skill of how to use his eyes. And you can watch in his eyes when he's relaxed, he's very busy, kind of looking around. And you kind of can see his eyes trying to focus and using his eyes and kind of moving around. And it's a very, very active activity, learning to develop a skill of how to use the eyes. And we take these things as being, you know, second nature or natural or inherent and effortless to do this. As a person grows, they develop a whole series of skills. And human being, it's so kind of hardwired or so deeply ingrained in the human nature to be driven, in a certain sense, to master all kinds of special skills. The skill to walk, for example, seems to be a real drive. And my first son, he was always kind of, that drive was so strong that he was always ahead of himself, always wanting to do what he couldn't do. And so he would try to stand or try to walk, and he'd fall or trip or, you know, he just couldn't do it yet, but he felt frustrated because he was trying to. And it's quite remarkable to watch the repetition of how these young children will repeat over and over and over again, endlessly until they've mastered something. I can't quite count how many times my son has tried to hold his head up, or my older son, how many times he tried to stand and fell and stood and fell and stood and fell, or started walking. The first time he walked, I was there. He did 7 steps before he fell. I figured 7 counted as walking. But then he fell. And he didn't beat himself up. He didn't criticize himself for being an utter failure or he was hopeless. But rather, he just then tried to stand again and tried to do it again. And endlessly, you know, he tried to develop a skill. And that's one of the qualities of developing a skill, is not being frustrated by failure. But rather, that's inherent in developing a skill, is that you don't learn to do it automatically firsthand, but you learn the skill and keep pushing the limits, the edges of your capacity, and then failing, and then learning from that how to, you know, to do better. And then as a person grows, it's not just physical skills, but also then it's mental skills, intellectual skills get developed. And some of them are developed inherently in who we are. I mean, like language is one. How to communicate and how to relate to other people in wise ways or unwise ways. How to get what you want. And some of it's the responsibility of the parents to help reinforce healthy forms of interpersonal relationship. And hopefully we'll get it right in the second son. The failures I had in, or the failures I had in raising my, mistakes I made, I had in raising my first child, were made up by the amount of attention the child got. And the second one doesn't get as much attention, but, you know, child rearing has been mastered. Another skill you have to learn is, I'm realizing this, it's a whole skill in raising children. It's very complex and constantly changing. I remember when I was in about 6th grade, I was in a very small school. I think the 5th, 6th, and 7th grade were so small, we were one class of about 10 students. And we had this very nice Mr. Kubik, who was our teacher. And we had this social studies class, or I don't know what it was. Maybe we didn't have classes, we just had lessons. And he pulled out Reader's Digest. And he had us read an article in Reader's Digest, I think several articles. And I think one was about somehow about America, and one was about the communist Russia back then. And he had us read these articles, and then he taught us how to read between the lines. And he taught us how you shouldn't just read what's on the surface, but you should kind of be sensitive to the intention of the author and he had us two different articles because he said these are two very radical different opinions being offered here. And the idea that when you read someone, it's an opinion, and you could listen to it carefully, that this is an opinion, what is the opinion here, and what's the facts here, was a skill that he was trying to teach me back in, you know, 6th grade or so. And I thought it was a very interesting lesson, a very important one as I went along with my life. Not to take things, you know, on the surface of them, but to look deeper down and try to understand. So as we're growing up, people try to teach us skills. all kinds of skills, and we learn skills as we grow up. And it's expected part of growing up. And here in America, there's cultural battles over what we teach our children, because we want to teach them certain skills, certain ways of understanding life, certain views, develop certain capacities, certain values. And the sad thing is that if parents or don't consider this, or if our school system don't consider this carefully, then there's the commercial interest in this culture who are very interested in shaping the processes of our children and their values and their skills. And so we have the media and advertisement and television, which are very powerful influences. And so part of the reason there's cultural battles is because there are these tremendous influences in our culture. Some of them we don't want our children to be under the influence of. And so we try to then to counter that with other ways, private schools or education or religious training or all kinds of things that people try to raise their children to be what they want them to be. One theory people have now that exists about why there's such a long period of dependency in human beings. You know, human beings are, you know, long period of training until they become adults and leave home. And it seems seemingly in modern society that period is longer than in some more traditional societies where you become an adult when you're 13 or 14 and you're off on your own. But here, you know, you're, in some ways you're a legal adult when you're 18, sometimes you're 21, and some people it takes a while longer before they become an adult, whatever that is. But one theory why such a long period of time is that human beings are not pre-programmed. They don't have these instincts about how to survive in their environment in the same way that some animals do that survive in particular niches. So some animals or plants, whatever, are extremely well adapted to particular niches of environments. And so they have these instincts. You just tell them how to survive in that environment. Take them out of that environment and they can't survive. Human beings don't have a particular niche that they're meant for. Human beings are amazingly adaptable. And so they can adapt themselves to all kinds of different environments. But in order to do that, they have to learn how to survive in that environment. And it takes a long time to really learn to master an environment. So we're born, you know, in some ways as a blank slate, in some ways not, but a blank slate so that we can learn the skills that are particular to the particular environment we're growing up in. So people who grew up, I remember an anthropologist or someone went into the some rainforest in Central America, and he was struck that the people who grew up in the rainforest, amazing skill they had in seeing into the forest. They could see things in subtle shifts. They see birds, you know, far in the distance. They were almost camouflaged, and they could see all this variety of things, where the person who grew up on the streets of New York couldn't see anything. It was just all blur of green. But you brought the person from the rainforest into New York, and it was all a blur. Whereas the New York person has learned all these skills of how to read the street signs, read the street, right? Have all street smarts, and they know what streets to go on and what not to go on, and, you know, all kinds of things that otherwise you wouldn't know. So the idea of developing skills, learning how to be adaptable, learning proficiency, is a very inherent, very important central part of being a human being. As we get up into adolescence and adulthood, then at some point we become self-conscious about these skills that we develop, and we can also suffer a lot because of it. You know, we're not up in schools where they give us grades for how proficient we get in certain areas, and it can get very traumatic, this area of skills and skillfulness. And some people just give up because it's just too much. Now, in one of the things that happens as we become an adult, though, I think, or as we get older, is that the whole process of developing a skill set, is something we can become self-reflective about. We can notice what it's like to develop a skill. And someone gave me recently quotations on this topic by a fellow named John Jerome, who wrote a couple of books about this, about developing skills and what it takes. And he was kind of watching himself in this process. And And so here's one description. He's learning how to swim. Okay, he knows how to swim, but he's refining his skill. He's developing his skill to a higher level. Over the summer, I would eventually put in enough swimming time to acquire a more accurate reading of what was going on between the water and my flesh and act more positively on that reading. I wasn't really that much stronger. I was just more effective. Sports requires a translation of desire into motion. You want to get into this or that position to be over there, to get there faster. You ask your physiology to perform the task. The better you read your state, body position, force, loadings, energy level, the better you carry out the task. Kinesthetic sense is the capacity to read all that and to respond with the most effective motions. That's what had the water rushing past my ears in the last days of my adolescent summers. It is also what made my stroke open up for me 30 summers later and begin taunting me to improve it. This kinesthetic sense is what teaches the skier to ride a flat ski, the racing driver to learn that smoother is finally faster. It is the capacity to sense the forces that will be needed and to marshal them, to perceive the forces at work and to cut through them in the quickest, cleanest ways. As with the Taoist cook, asked why his knife never needs sharpening, simple, he says, he doesn't cut the meat. He uses his knife to separate it, following the natural divisions of the flesh. So this is a description of developing a skill. And here, a very important aspect he emphasizes is being able to read the situation really well, to read one's own condition, to read the condition one situation one is in, and find the right adjustment to be able to be most effective within it. And as I learn about the human mind, the human's inner life, and how we relate to our environment, I think of it as being incredibly complex. The human mind is like an ecology in itself. And there's many different aspects of that ecology. And we can emphasize different aspects of it, as different spiritual practices will emphasize different areas and different aspects of who we are. But the mind is a huge ecology. And learning to read the mind, to learn to read what's going on, and develop skill within it, is one of the capacities we have. Some people will have a spiritual approach where they kind of take one, you know, they find one teaching or one practice, and this is the way to do it. There's one way, there's a right way of doing it. And as I read the teachings of the early Buddha, it isn't so much as there's a one way to do it, a right way of doing it, as it is there's a way of developing skillfulness, a way of being sensitive and reading the situation and finding how to adapt oneself and respond appropriately in different situations. So this puts a lot of responsibility on us as an individual to do that reading, to read our situation, to read what's going on, rather than having, you know, it's quite a relief to think like you have the key, you have one simple answer to a spiritual life. And then you try to apply that in all kinds of different situations. Or you become a fundamentalist and hold on really tight to this one thing. The mind, as it gets developed in Buddhism, is meant to become fluid and soft and open. There's descriptions of the mind becoming very soft and fluid, malleable. And a malleable and fluid mind, I think, is one that is able to, is adaptable to the situation, knows how to work, not holding on to one particular thing, but learns how to read the situation. So you find in Buddhism a whole series of different kinds of practices that a person can learn. And then you apply those different practices to different situations that we find ourselves in, or different aspects, different skills, different inner qualities that need to be developed in different kinds of situations to get the right balance, depending what's going on. Here's a different description, somewhat similar. The athlete is in the business of getting the physics right, of selecting from circumstances that are rapidly changing the right kind of force to apply for the right length of time at just the right angle in just the right amount. athletics concerns itself with making judgments about physical laws, acceleration and deceleration, momentum and mass, vectors of force, that kind of thing, and putting these judgments into effect. The better athlete is the one who works these laws more effectively. Nothing heroic about it. There is a silken, almost magical ease to the movements of the great athletes, instantly recognizable, but not so easy to define. We credit them with almost mystical powers. They're only getting the physics right. We speak of their movements as beautiful, but what we mean is efficient, or maybe just appropriate. The thing that rivets us visually in athletics or dance, the same thing, is the startling efficiency of the exactly appropriate move. It is more pleasurable to make those moves than to watch them, of course. It's more pleasurable to make those moves than to watch them, of course. One gets a hint of their pleasures when a large stone slips easily into place. Here he's talking about building a stone wall. To making judgments. In my language of my last few talks, being discerning. A very important part of being skillful, developing a skill and being skillful, is to be very discerning. Discerning with the situation, make judgments of what the appropriate response is. Now, I know that in terms of meditation, to talk this way, developing a skill, having different practice, being able to read what's going on carefully in different situations, making judgments and being discerning of what to do, can sound very busy, like you're doing a lot, and very involved. A great analogy is that of riding a bicycle, is that it's also a skill we develop. And at first, learning that skill, it can be very awkward. We fall down, and someone's spotting us, and we're very wobbly. But after a while, you might get so good at riding a bicycle, you don't have to use the handlebar anymore. You can ride without your hands. It's just second nature. And you're ready to, you can read the situation, you read the road, and you read yourself, and the wind, and all kinds of things. And you know, almost, without even thinking about it, the kind of decisions and discernment you need to be able to ride smoothly. You go up a hill, and you know that, naturally almost, you know that it requires more effort, more energy. Or you see how long the hill is, and you know, I have to pace myself here. And there's all these decisions get made. Meditation can be done the same way. However, through experience and through different trial and error and different ways, after a while, this becomes second nature. And it doesn't take away from the stillness of the mind. It actually can promote it, the mind becoming peacer, more and more peaceful. But it takes some time of awkwardness to learn the skills. And in different situations, you might learn how to be smooth and peaceful in certain situations, but then something happens in your life, and you don't have that anymore. So the virtue of having just one simple practice is that sometimes you can get very calm and very peaceful until the environment or your inner life changes so dramatically that that is not available anymore. The advantage of developing a skill set, is that you can apply it in all kinds of different situations. So for me right now, I have two children at home, and I find that life is very complex. Yesterday, I had to make breakfast. I don't have to, but I made breakfast holding a baby who was kind of fussy and kind of crying, and trying to take care of the four-year-old who wanted to play with and wanted to, help in his activity, and was holding on and various things, and trying to make breakfast, because I knew if I didn't make breakfast on the table quickly enough, the four-year-old would get more and more wound up because he needed to eat. And I didn't want to bother the mother because the mother had been up half the night feeding the first one. So, it's complex. And some of you probably know this. I don't know how to tell you. But one of the things I find some refuge in or solace in this complexity of all this, and my own inner life is complex dealing with all this, is that the idea that what I'm doing here is developing skill. I'm developing skills in this activity, and not just simply external skills, but spiritual skills, skills in within myself of how to stay balanced, how to stay peaceful, how to stay concentrated, how to stay discerning, stay awake, be present. I'm developing skills, and knowing that I'm doing this actually gives me some encouragement in what I'm doing. And maybe I should be encouraged to do it regardless of that, But it's part of my spiritual life. It's part of my practice life. And rather than feeling overwhelmed, which occasionally I do with all this complexity, I see it as a greater challenge. Oh, this area too, I get to develop these skills. It's great. I love it. And then John Jerome writes, the better the work goes, the deeper I get into the problem, the stiller I get. Have you noticed that ever? I know that for a long time with meditation, I thought stillness or peacefulness, very deep calm, was something that came from letting my mind become simpler and simpler, doing less and less. To some degree, that's true, or to a great degree, that's true. But one way into that is to be very engaged and very involved, in his language, the problem of the mind, the problem of meditation. Be engaged in the process of developing a skill, reading and understanding and looking and be engaged. Because one of the things you're doing then is by default, you're in the present moment. And so rather than fighting and struggling to be in the present moment, if you're so involved in an activity of what you're doing in the present moment, you'll naturally be in the present moment. So sometimes it can be, you can take meditation to be a game. Playfulness is very helpful. And you'll find yourself very easily in the present moment. I'm not exactly going to recommend this, but this is something I've done occasionally, is I used to like playing pinball machines. And sometimes I've imagined that meditation, I was playing a pinball machine with my thoughts. And, I was going to, catch those thoughts every time they arose. Like a, like a pinball machine or like a tennis or something. And it was very engaging, and I didn't have to question, how am I going to be in the present moment? I was involved in the game. I was very present. And then after a while, I find myself, a momentum of being present. In Southeast Asia, in Thailand, where they have a different culture and different understanding of self, they have ideas like this that doesn't work so well here in the West, but they'll take the mind as their adversary, as their enemy. And they don't want the mind to be in charge. They want to be in charge, as if they're different than their mind. And the mind, the mind in charge is the mind of delusion, greed, and hate. You get pulled around by your desires and your wants and everything. And so they see the mind as their worthy adversary. You want to have a worthy adversary. And so they're going to kind of, fight the mind as the language some teachers have in Southeast Asia. You're going to fight these forces and try to overcome them. This doesn't work so well here in the West because we have such an adversarial relationship to ourselves already that if we end up doing that kind of activity, then it just kind of becomes tighter and tighter and more and more morbid in the process of practice. To develop a skill set, to become skillful. Part of developing a skill is so that the mind is not in charge, so that we can have some ability to be in charge of the forces that influence what we say and do and act on and feel. Part of developing skillfulness, I've noticed, is that it's very humbling to do it. Because it's often, especially with things that are not so easy to develop, I think developing the mind is a humbling activity. And being humble, I think, is often very helpful for spiritual life. That if we're kind of arrogant about our capacity, that's not very helpful. I remember when I was, I ran a race many years ago. It was called a no race. It was a Zen race. And some people, point wasn't exactly to win, except for the people who are competitive. There were always some people in the front competing. But I remember once I was, doing this race. It was a very difficult race. It was basically uphill 5 miles the whole way. And so I was running this race. And I wasn't, racing. I was just trying to get up to the top. And I was about halfway, I think. And this woman started passing me. And she seemed pretty good at it, but she was huffing and puffing some, but she was passing me. And as she passed me, she said, every year, she ran the race every year, this mountain humbles me. And so develop a skill, helps build, it involves patience and humility to some degree. So there I am, swimming along, grinding out the yardage, minding my own business, when, after a year of fairly heavy training, my swimming stroke suddenly unfolds for me, like one of those Japanese paper flowers that open up underwater. I stop in the middle of a set, breaking the unwritten law of workouts, to hang out in the gutter and think about it for a moment. It is almost eerie in the clarity with which it happens. So, you know, we engage ourselves in skill developing, practice, doing things over and over again, being engaged. And then sometimes some of the breakthroughs or some of the changes or some of the development of that skill that happens can have a kind of magical quality, because even though we're responsible for putting in the effort, it's something else that seems to kind of switch us over to a higher level. Have you noticed that sometimes? And but we have to do the effort. We have to put in our effort for something else to happen. I've seen that many times in my life with decisions I've had to make. I had to kind of very engaged in thinking about the problem, the decision. But the decision didn't come from thinking about it. I had to be open to something else. The physical epiphanies available in working with wood, here's a different skill, woodworking, and metal and stone are no different from those other little instants when some flicker of truth comes in, when the information from some sense organ or other succeeds in breaking through. I always thought these moments were supposed to be intellectual, the product of pure abstract thought. But they come to us through the sense organs. It was the taste of the apple, I think, that flipped us out of Eden into the world. So to develop a skill in meditation, it involves many different aspects then. It involves being able to read our situation, read who we are. We sit down to meditate and to really take stock of who we are at that moment, what's going on, and then what's the best approach to take given what's going on. Sometimes one that's very accepting and very compassionate. Sometimes one that's very firm and directed and determined. Sometimes what we need is to emphasize the emptiness of the mind or the peacefulness of the mind and just kind of do nothing. Doing nothing is the best approach. Sometimes developing loving kindness or compassion is the best approach, given what we read, what we find when we tune in inside. And but if we only develop one particular practice, one particular way, then we're only developing one skill. And over a complex life, I think there are different skills which are required. And that's why constantly reading our situation, taking stock, is an important part of what we do. And then the five faculties are kind of the five beautiful lists that the Buddha had, which could be applied to any skill development, sports, crafts, music, whatever, that five faculties need to come into balance, need to play a part. And different times, different faculties might be weak. And so we develop some of these faculties. So these apply to meditation too. Confidence. To have confidence in your ability to develop a skill. To have confidence that you can do it. You need to have that. Otherwise, you're going to be inhibited by your doubt. So some degree of confidence. What does it take to have confidence? One of the things it takes is to know that it takes a long time to develop a skill. And that don't give up by a few days or months or years of failure. You keep applying yourself and applying yourselves. Another is effort. Knowing the right kind of effort to make. To use the analogy of a bicycle, riding a bicycle. There are times when you know it's best not to apply effort in riding a bike. Maybe you're going downhill. And making more effort to pump the pedals is the wrong thing to do. You just want to coast. If you're on flat ground, a certain kind of effort is needed. If you're going up a hill, a different kind of effort is needed. Maybe you go slower, but you have to actually make greater effort. And it's required going up the hill. When we sit down to meditate, The same thing. There are times when the mind is coasting along. It's very easy to be in the present moment. And you just kind of want to maintain a certain momentum in mindfulness. Other times when you're going downhill in the mind, healthy in a healthy way, kind of down towards greater peace and calm, and you want to just get out of the way. And just get out of your own way. Get out of your own way. Don't do anything that gets you in the way. And other times when you have to really put yourself in there, and it's hard labor to do meditation. When the mind is very agitated, for example, or you're just filled with a desire for something, and the mind keeps going into that desire and the thoughts and the fantasies, and sometimes you need the hard labor to kind of just overcome the strength of that distracted mind. Mindfulness, to be present. You need to be present to develop a skill. Any skill, I think, you have to really be present. The more present you can be, the more your body, your mind, your heart, everything can take in the information, can read what's going on, and use the kind of feedback loop of self-reflection that feeds back into applying the skill. So this involves monitoring ourselves. And part of mindfulness is to monitor ourselves as we do the process of meditation, a kind of self-monitoring process. How's it going here? What am I doing? How are things developing? To have some sense that meditation, it does involve going someplace, developing the mind. Not to be casual or just, you know, to have a magical approach to meditation. If I just sit down, then something will happen. And there's many different goals that people can have for meditation. Monitor, am I getting closer to my goal? Am I becoming more peaceful as I do this? Am I becoming more calm? Am I becoming more compassionate? Am I becoming more discerning to be able to recognize the impulses that drive me and run me so that I'm not driven by them so much anymore in my life? Then concentration. To be able to concentrate on a particular skill set and a particular activity. To really not just simply be aware and monitor it, but to really concentrate and focus on this thing that you're doing. And then the last of the faculties is discernment. To be discerning. To make judgments about what you're doing. Is this useful? Is it not useful? Is it helpful? Is it not helpful? All these five things have to come into play in meditation. They can be second nature, like riding a bicycle becomes, you don't even think about it anymore. But all these five, be involved in them and to monitor them and be developing them, paradoxically, there's a way of doing it that can make the mind very, very still and quiet and peaceful. One of the key skills or key directions that the Buddhist skillfulness is trying to lead us towards is towards becoming peaceful or no longer be in conflict with ourselves and the world around us. And that's one of the things we monitor. Am I moving in that direction? How is this supportive of becoming more peaceful? If the very way in which we're trying to develop the skill or practicing is making us more agitated or more tight, then we need to have the self-monitoring of the practice to make a course adjustment. You know, how I'm doing it now is just not working. I'm getting a headache. I'm getting too tight. I'm getting too discouraged. Maybe I need to find another way to do it. So I'm inclining myself to a greater peace, more peacefulness. The word in Pali is kusala. It's a very important word in the teachings of the Buddha to develop a skill. He uses a lot of analogies, the Buddha, of developing skills in crafts and music, farming, for what we do in meditation practice. And you find this idea of kusala, of a skill, also very important in other Indian spiritual traditions. You find it in yoga, in the Bhagavad Gita. There's a very central Hindu text. It defines yoga as action which is skillful. Action which is skillful. Action which is skillful in keeping us from getting caught or attached or clinging to the things of the world. So as you go on your meditation practice, one particular skill that you might want to try to develop is a skill of how not to get caught by your thoughts. To notice a thought when it arises, to notice when the mind is latched onto it, and to notice or to develop the skill to let go of it. Develop that one skill, learning not to get caught, and a lot of other skills will follow in its wake. So, that's it. I hope this is useful. I hope none of you feel oppressed by all the hard work this implies. But you could also think of it as hard play. I hope you really enjoy it. I really love it. It's really fun. When things are really going well, you know, and with developing a skill, even though it can be so complex, it's just such a pleasure. So thank you.